The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We don't have quorum yet, but we will soon enough. In the meantime, Senator Latz, Senate File 927.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is a bill that would expand the list of crimes for which the family of a victim would be entitled to take leave from their place of employment to attend court with the victim. Current law provides that a victim's spouse or next of kin would be entitled to take reasonable time off from work to attend criminal proceedings in cases that involve first and second degree murder, assault in the first degree, third degree murder, and a few of the criminal sexual conduct crimes. I think first, second, and third degree crim sex if force or violence was involved or if minor was involved. The change that's proposed here would expand the list of crimes beyond those to basically all violent crimes. And that list then would include murders 1 through 3, manslaughter 1st through 3rd degree, assault 1st through 4th degree, knowing transfer of a communicable disease, domestic assault, female genital mutilation, domestic assault by strangulation, great bodily harm caused by distribution of drugs, frankly, another page of crimes. These include robbery, neglect, all of the crim sex cases, labor trafficking, and malicious punishment of a child, neglect or endangerment of a child, drive-by shootings, first-degree burglary. All of these kinds of cases in which the victim would be substantially traumatized by the case and in which it would be beneficial for the victim's well-being as well as for the ability of the state to have a victim who's in a position to effectively testify to the actual facts of what happened in courtroom proceedings. So that's the gist of the bill. I do have two witnesses here with me in support of the bill from the Crime Victims Coalition and the Coalition for Battered Women.
Senator Latz, what is not included?
Embezzlement?
Well, there there are a lot of crimes that are in 609 that are not covered by these. If you want some more specifics, I can ask Ms. Notice from the General Crime Victims Coalition to give you a little more detail. But, for example, there's the first through fourth degree assaults are covered. Fifth degree assault is not.
Ms. Notice, welcome back to the committee. In your comments, I hope that you would perhaps give us a insight into the rationale for why these list of crimes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. Thank you for inviting me here to speak today. My name is Jennifer Notice, and I'm the Executive Director for the General Crime Coalition. I have come today to urge you to approve the proposed legislation before you. In the many years I've worked with victims of crime, one theme is universal. The support of their loved one is what carries them through, what allows them to face their fear, the pain and the grief, and what ultimately allows them to heal. Other than the actual criminal event itself, the criminal proceedings are often the most daunting and frightening time for the victim in relation to the crime. During criminal proceedings, a victim often relives the events of the crime, often suffers incredible anxiety, and desperately leans on those who are close. Unfortunately, as the current law reads, those victims of violent crime are often not able to rely on the attendance of their loved ones during criminal proceedings due to unaccommodating work schedules and or employers. This is a truly a crisis for victims, for during their greatest time of need, they're alone. In reality, this bill does not impact those individuals who are able to use sick time, vacation time, or leave options through their employer. Nor does it impact those whose employers are sympathetic and permit unpaid time off. Rather, this bill impacts those workers, typically in the service or the labor industry, who do not have the benefits of sick time, vacation time, or unpaid time off. This bill reasonably allows these individuals unpaid time off to attend these proceedings without the threat or fear of retaliation by the employer. In preparing the list in which you have before you, we looked at violent crimes, crimes in which the victim actually had some personal consequence from. We didn't look at any financial crimes, and we also tended to look more towards the gross misdemeanor or the felony level. So an example of what you wouldn't find on there is there's no order for protection violations on there. There's no harassment restraining order violations. There's no assault in the fifth degree violations. Those are all misdemeanor level offenses. We looked into those that are the most severe that the victims, in our experience, have had the greatest need for having a support system or a support person with them when they attend court. On that basis, I again just urge the committee to approve the legislation. I believe that the scope and the impact is limited. We spent a great amount of time looking at the different crimes and narrowing that list to what we thought was appropriate. But I believe that the impact on victims during their time of need is incredible. Thank you very much, and I look forward to any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Notice. Let's see, Ms. Ferrucci.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just am here to echo and support what Jennifer and Senator Latz have said. As you know, many times in these cases, victims are not present in the courtroom because they're witnesses, and we just think it's very important for them to have their next of kin or a partner there to be able to witness what's going on in the courtroom and to help monitor what's going on in the courtroom. And so we just encourage you and the committee to support this bill.
Any questions for the witnesses from members?
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I've got more question regarding the bill. And the current law says on page 1, line 9, that the person would have
T-Mobile is calling, Senator.
Would have time, time from work to attend. It says criminal proceedings relating to the victim's case. Are we only talking about court proceedings? Are there things beyond court proceedings? I don't know if the word criminal proceedings is, I mean, I think I know what they're saying, but are we just only talking about going to court? Are we talking about going to meet with a detective? What are we referring to when we're talking about criminal proceedings?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I might need to rely on counsel for this, but I would expect criminal proceedings certainly covers court because proceedings tends to be a term of art, but I suppose it might be interpreted to include meeting with a detective or having a consultation with the prosecuting attorneys in preparation for court proceedings as well. It doesn't say court proceedings, so it does say criminal proceedings.
Well, and Madam,
that's existing law, by the way.
Well, I recognize it's existing law, but that's, you know, we're expanding the current statute, and I'm not quite sure if it is clear in reading this what it is that the person is going to be given time off to go to. Is it only going to be for court proceedings? Is it something other than court proceedings? It says criminal proceedings, but I'm not quite sure I understand what that would be.
Ms. Notice, what does this encompass under current law? Is it just court proceedings?
In my understanding, it's been used to apply to both court proceedings as well as meeting with court personnel beforehand or investigators in relation to the case.
So, Ms. Notice, how much would that mean in terms of time off for the employee, for an employee potentially involving in something like this?
It's really difficult to estimate in that regard because it depends on the nature of the crime. If we do have a manslaughter case, you may see a trial that may extend 3 to 4 weeks, or you may have a settlement at the first appearance. So it's really difficult to put an estimation for each individual case. It could vary so drastically.
And Ms. Notice, under current law, if people take time off to do this, are they they must be using up vacation times or foregoing pay of some sort, correct?
Correct. At this time, if they're able to use their sick or their vacation time, they do so up until the point where they run out. And then up until that point, what we found is that they, with employers who are sympathetic, they're able to do unpaid time off. But again, this bill really is addressing those individuals who aren't seeking sympathetic employers, who may be facing some retaliation to the point where they may be threatened their position or their job if they decide to attend the proceedings.
And you said, Ms. Norris, that maximum somebody could be asking anywhere up to a couple of 2-3 weeks time off?
Well, again, it's going to depend on the nature of the crime and the extent of the criminal proceedings, which, yes, could extend in a very severe case up to several weeks at a time. I think the bill really is going towards the need to prevent these individuals from being retaliated against for their need to be there for their family member and really being supportive of that victim who needs that support person there to make it through that event and to properly heal and understand what they're going through.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns I would have in this, I think the idea is great, but for people that deal with essential services, when I was on the Highway Patrol, we couldn't rely on not having troopers to fill those slots. The same would apply with firemen and other kinds of people. And so it would seem appropriate that there be some limitation on this. And I'm not willing to apply any specific amount, but I think it, in the interests of justice, why that'd be better served.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, the current statute applies to victims and to their families. I think as a matter of public policy and to better serve justice, we do not want to place crime victims who typically are needed in order to prove the case against the defendant to have to choose between keeping their job and being a witness in a case against an alleged perpetrator. The interests of justice would be ill-served if you get to the trial date on a domestic assault case and the victim is not allowed time off from work to attend, doesn't have, even if they have leave time. Sometimes it's not only the employee's choice of whether they can use leave time for a particular time, but the employer still has to approve it. If they don't show up in court, the charges might be dismissed. So there's no way to predict with any kind of certainty how long a particular case might end up in trial. Now, typically, trials are not 2 or 3 weeks long, but on some of the most heinous crimes, they can be. And I would suggest it would be precisely in those most heinous crimes that justice would insist that the victim, again, not have to choose between losing their job and being a witness against the perpetrator of a most heinous type of crime.
Senator Latz, what is the difference between striking heinous and inserting violent? And then what impact does that change have on the rest of the statutory language in this chapter?
Madam Chair, I think it's all a matter of definition. Violent crime is used in other contexts and in statute and otherwise and is a more easily understood term. Whatever term is used, what's most important is a list of crimes. The statutory references that list the applicable crimes. But violent crime is more generally understood and more broadly encompasses the longer list of crimes that are covered.
Mr. Backus, is this going to create inconsistencies or confusion in other parts of this this chapter?
Madam Chair and members, the definition here is limited to this section. So, and I think I was guessing that that's perhaps why one other reason they decided to switch from the term heinous to the term violent, because heinous is a definition we have as well in another statute. So perhaps they thought it would be better not to have two definitions of a heinous, where two definitions or three or more of violent crime is probably more acceptable.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I think this bill is covering just the spouse or the next of kin that this would be available for. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, as well as the victim, him or herself.
Okay. Did you contemplate other family members? Let me tell you where I'm going. had a constituent, I guess it's been three or four years ago now, whose brother was murdered over in Wisconsin, and it turns out he was murdered by his wife. And so, she ultimately went to trial, and, you know, the people who to speak for him at the trial and to kind of keep track of things were his siblings. And my constituent basically did lose her job over it. It was you know, something that kind of took over her life for months. And I think you're on the right track here, but I'm wondering whether there isn't some accommodation that could be made for a broader group of people.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, the sentiment would be the same, I would think, applying to immediate family members as well as to mm-hmm. next of kin, and maybe the term immediate family member would be an appropriate amendment to cover that kind of a situation. You never know when you look at a family which family member is going to be the most valuable as an emotional support for the victim of a crime, and maybe statute shouldn't be making those distinctions for the victim.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, I'm extremely sympathetic to what victims go through in these situations. I've been through this with victims many times as an attorney, and I know the value of having a family member there for them emotionally. But I'm just wondering, in trying to balance, and I concur with Senator Higgins that a lot of times in the experiences I've seen, it's a parent. A lot of these are single women, sometimes men, but more often single women, and they don't have a spouse to go through the situation. So oftentimes it's another family member. But in balancing that, and I guess I would just say to the committee members, too, this isn't a free time off. I mean, most people aren't going to want to take any more time off than they absolutely have to, because they either will be using vacation time or they won't be paid. But I noticed there's also the word reasonable in here in terms of qualifying the amount of time off a person's able to take. And I wonder if there's been any case law or how has that term reasonable been used in this statute?
Senator Latz, any response to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we're not aware of any case law that's addressed, although I'll concede I have not done any research on that question. I'm afraid I can't give you much of an answer on that.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, one of the things that you mentioned was the victim and not being able to get to the place without losing their job. What it would seem to me that in some part of your amendment that you include something that says that the victim and the witnesses have the right to go there. If they're the only two that this law applies to, two categories that this law applies, then you probably use that language to fill it out a little more. It just doesn't say that in the existing law, so it could mean anybody that might be denied your time off.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, usually witnesses that are not the victim are subpoenaed, at least if they're critical witnesses for the case. It's often more difficult to subpoena a victim, and sometimes victims are reluctant on occasion, too. And I honestly don't know what the law is with regard to subpoenas and employer retaliation if a person responds to a subpoena and leaves work without getting approval. But as a practical matter, you wouldn't be in a position to subpoena family members of non-witness family members of a victim. There wouldn't be any reason for the court case or the prosecutor to subpoena, say, the brother of the victim or the parent of the victim who's not a witness for the case. Yet they might still be critical to the successful prosecution of the case if they can provide the emotional support for the victim to attend and to be comfortable enough reliving the experience and testifying effectively.
Mr. Backus, can you... I have a question about this next of kin thing. Is there a definition in the statute on what that is?
Madam Chair and members, it's not defined in this particular section, and to Ms. Panis and I were conferring, we don't believe it's defined that we know of either in statute.
So next of kin could just be any family member? I mean, that's pretty, it seems like it's pretty broad, and it would give maximum flexibility to whoever the family member would be. Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure about that. I would think it would mean, you know, like whoever would be next in line, I guess, in terms of an inheritance or something like that, if you die intestate. That's what I'm familiar with. So I don't know it would give you the flexibility. It might specifically refer to some one person, whoever's next closest to you in the bloodline.
I see. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, that's how I would think of it, too. I would say, for example, if a person was unmarried, then probably their parent would be their next of kin. But if they were married and had a spouse, then the parent probably wouldn't qualify as next of kin. I mean, that's just, there's usually kind of, from an inheritance standpoint, so I guess that's how I was kind of thinking of it.
So, Senator Latz and Ms. Notice, does that not create a problem if the next of kin is somebody that the individual doesn't necessarily want to be there? Let's say if the person is closer to their niece than their brother, or, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem to give the victim a choice by defining it's either a spouse or a next of kin. Or are you satisfied that that language gives you enough flexibility to the victim?
Well, Madam Chair, I think the illustration by Senator Higgins also pointed out some of the difficulties with next of kin as language. I think also that it might have a very specific interpretation in the inheritance statutes or the intestacy statutes, and we might need a little broader definition. Now, how broad that definition is, a family member, you know, would be open for discussion, I suppose. If you said immediate family member, or if you just said, you know, a family member, a member of the family. I mean, I don't know if you want to go any further than that, but.
Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, I was thinking about, you know, maybe next of kin is more, it maybe not the right phrase, and I was thinking immediate family members. At some point, though, there are going to be other people that this isn't going to apply to. What about fiancé? What about buddy? You know, I mean, it's just going to, there are people that probably would be very close to a victim who are not going to be covered by this, but I don't think we can. But I think we might be at least helping a little bit if instead of next of kin, we might say immediate family members. That might be a way to at least get more people that might be closer to people beyond whatever next of kin happens to be, because if we don't know what it is, I don't know how anybody reading the statute is going to figure it out.
Ms. Notice, Senator Latz, do you have any objections to that?
No, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'll move on page 1, line 8, strike next of kin and insert immediate family members.
On Senator Betzel's motion, any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
We're talking about a longer list and more people getting time off of work to be attending something. I am wondering if on line 9 we struck the word criminal and inserted the word judicial, what would be the effect of doing that? Because I'm not sure what criminal proceedings are. I think I know what a court proceeding is.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think that would open it up to civil damage suits arising out of the same facts that gave rise to criminal charges. I don't know if that would be Senator Betzold's intent, but at least the use of the term judicial proceedings could do that.
I don't know if that's good or not, or criminal court proceedings, but at least criminal proceedings, I think, is somewhat vaguely, it's not defined. If I said judicial proceedings, that would involve some sort of a court proceedings, and there could be civil proceedings that tie into a criminal proceeding.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I'd be reluctant to limit it to court proceedings or judicial proceedings for fear that it might be interpreted to not allow meetings with investigators or prosecutors in the prosecutor's offices that may be precursors to court proceedings or tangential to them, nevertheless very important, but not specifically in court.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz and Senator Betzold, one of the other specific situations that comes to mind where a victim can feel really intimidated is at the time that they have to make an identification of a witness. And I think besides just the emotional support, one of the benefits to this is you often have a real imbalance of power in these situations, and having someone with in those situations so that they don't feel so intimidated by the witness, and that identification procedure is one of those times where I think you'd really want to have someone have some support.
Any further discussions on Senate File 927?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
I've got a stylistic question, and I need to pose it. You know, I've just counted up, there's 46 statutory references in here. And in order for me to make sense, if I'm looking at the statute, I have to probably look up each one of them to figure out what it's there. I think years ago I had this trend, and I since abandoned it, but sometimes I would say, is there a way we can, like, put section 609.185 parentheses murder of the first degree, 609.195, murder of the third degree. Is there a way that we can, you know, put the description after the section so that somebody who's reading this can get an idea of what those sections are, because it doesn't, it's just numbers here, and then if you're going to look up all 46 of them, then you got to, your work on your hands. It adds you know, a little bit to the statute books, but I think it makes it a little more user-friendly. I don't know what the stylistic guides are on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold, if you are wondering what the stylistic guide is, then the rest of us are lost.
No, I don't know. in drafting the bills, and I know that council has some guidelines that they're supposed to follow in the bills. Now, sometimes we violate them all over the place and we do things, but I don't know what guidance they have when they make these laundry lists. Should they or should they not, or does anybody care?
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
The DWI statute a few years ago was amended to include the exact kind of stylistic suggestion that Senator Betzold is suggesting, and it makes it much more easy to navigate through the DWI statute and all the related statutes that go with it. I would support an amendment to include the name of the crime and not just the statute number.
Mr. Backus.
Yes. Madam Chair, members, I was going to point that out too as well, but the DWI code also has at the very beginning a specific reference that parentheticals are merely headnotes. They're not substantive. So there is that there. But I was paging through statute, and I realized when we redid the definition of crime and violence, for example, in the gun law a few years ago, they put the parentheticals in. I mean, there's always some concern that if you misdescribe it somehow, that might be considered substantive. But there is example where we've done it even when we haven't had that explanation. So I think you could do that if you'd like.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move we direct counsel to put the parenthetical descriptions in the statutory references in this bill.
And insert in there the language that parentheticals are not.
Yeah, and I'd give counsel license to make it fit.
On Senator Betzel's motion, any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senate File 927. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 927, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Senator Torres Ray, Senate File 1221.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present my bill to the committee today.
Senator, do you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I have Amendment A7. I don't know if you have it before right you here. Or it will be distributed. This is an amendment to that will require the Department of Human Services to create a form to document voluntary placement agreements for children who have developmental disabilities or emotional disturbances who need out-of-home placement. And we have consulted with the department, and the department is okay with this amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray, I think that this can't be added on as an author's amendment because it's a first engrossment, but we'll get someone to move it for you. Senator Higgins moves the A7 amendment. Senator Torres-Ray, can you explain what the reason is that we need to do this?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for advice on this, and I have Mrs. Sue Abdelhort.
You introduce yourself.
I will do that.
I can never pronounce your last
name. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Abdelhort, Executive Director of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. The reason that NAMI put forward this amendment and working with the department is that, as you know, if a parent has a child with an emotional disturbance or developmental disability and they can't pay for the residential services that the child needs, they have to actually go through kind of the CHIPS law in order for the county to get legal authority to place the child and then obtain federal funds in order to do that. But they don't actually have to give up legal custody, and that's one of the issues, you know, nationwide. That's a problem in terms of families having to relinquish custody. Minnesota did change its law, but we only have anecdotal evidence of it working or not working. And so what we wanted to do was to create a form to make it very clear that voluntary placement agreements can be done, and then to track how many are done. We know in looking at the statistics that about 5,000 kids go into out-of-home placement because of their behavior. We don't know if that's really, if voluntary placements were done or whether parents eventually are forced to give up custody. So we really wanted to get a handle on the situation.
Ms. Abdelhalden, how come this amendment wasn't put on in health?
Oh, Madam Chair, because it wasn't ready yet. We were still working with the department on coming to an agreement on what it would be.
And was this amendment alluded to in the health committee with the understanding that once the bill gets to this committee, it would be put on?
Madam Chair, no, it wasn't.
And are you aware of whether or not there will be any objections from the health committee about? I understand that it's under the statutory section is under our jurisdiction, but you know it's a substantive policy discussion, and so I just wondered if the health committee is going to have heartburn over this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this doesn't change existing policy. What it really is doing is creating a form so that we can make sure that we're kind of promoting the idea that you can do voluntary placement agreements and then trying to track how often those occur. So it's really not changing how we do things. It's trying to track what we're doing.
And Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, is it together?
That is correct.
The department is okay with this?
Madam Chair, yes, we are.
Members, Senator Higgins renews her motion that on the A7 amendment. You know, members, this is a little bit unusual because typically I've been very strict that we only review the portions that are before this committee, and any amendments or any testimony or changes to the bill should come within that section. I'm a little bit concerned, although it is just a form. But I think what I'd like to do is we'll put it on, and then I'm going to go talk to the chair about this amendment. And if there's an issue, then Senator Torres-Ray, if there is an issue, then will you agree to take it out?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I am a co-chair of that committee, so I'll be happy to talk to Senator Marty and the members of the committee, and if there are any objections, I'll see what is it. I'll investigate what the procedure is to make sure that we bring it back or bring it back to that committee for approval or bring it back here. I don't know what it will be, but I'm open to do whatever is necessary.
All right. On the 87 amendment, any further discussions? Anybody in the audience who needs to testify on this amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Now, let's see.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate file 1221 is an attempt to bring the Minnesota statutes into compliance with federal legislation, and this is basically what we are going to present to you today. It covers some issues related to permanency for children, and it addresses several technical amendments that need to be done to state legislation, and I have with me a representative of the department who will be presenting the bill for you, and there are others who will be available to respond to questions in case you have any questions for them.
Ms. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the memo telling us all the various things that are these all the things that are before the committee?
No, Senator Higgins, only Article 1 is before the committee.
Only Article 1. Okay, I missed that. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I apologize. I should have made that more clear. Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, is this a department bill, Senator Torres, right?
That's correct, right. Madam Chair.
And so only Article 1, I believe Council has informed me that only Article 1 is before the committee. Ms. Sullivan-Sutton, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill before you this afternoon. What my plan had been was to go through just those provisions in Article 1 that are under the purview of your committee. So if that's acceptable, I will proceed.
Please proceed.
Sections 2, 6, and 20 of the bill deal with situations involving 14-year-olds where there's been a termination of parental rights and the child is a ward of the state. Under normal circumstances, agencies have continuing obligations to find a permanent family for a child where there's been a termination. However, in Minnesota, we've had a practice in place where a 14-year-old can be asked whether they want to sign an affidavit indicating that they don't want to be adopted and can decline or waive an agency's obligation to find them a permanent family. These provisions would ensure that the child continued to have the ability and the right to consent to any adoption, but would eliminate the affidavit and require that the agencies continue through to find a permanent child for a permanent family for that child, and the child would be available to be on the state adoption exchange. And of course, that is necessary in order to reduce the number of teenagers we have exiting out of our systems without permanent families. Sections 3 and 4 of the bill simply deal with the timing for the court administrator's office to send in to the department petitions for adoptions and decrees of adoptions for those adoptions that we have responsibility for purposes of record keeping. Section 6, as I mentioned, is related to the 14-year-old situation. Section 7 and a number of the other provisions which I will point out are necessary in order to come into compliance with a recently passed Safe and Timely Interstate Placement of Children Act that was passed by Congress this past fall. And Section 7 simply requires that agency consider both placements within the state as well as out of the state when a permanent placement is being sought. And that is simply to assure that geographic boundaries are not barriers to permanency for children. Section 8 of the bill provides a clarification of the definition of Indian tribe consistent with federal law. Section 9 of the bill is a clarification of the definition of tribal court and recognition that a tribal court need not be federally recognized. Section 10 and 11 of the bill require active efforts for agencies to identify and locate extended family members when working with Indian children, and that's consistent with other active efforts requirements under the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Indian Family Preservation Act. Section 12 clarifies jurisdiction for an Indian child residing or domiciled on a reservation and wards of tribal court. Section 13 of the bill ensures application of the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act to any custody proceeding involving an Indian child, whether or not the child was raised as part of an Indian family or has contact with the tribe. That's consistent with the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act, which very clearly states that its applicability to all Indian children who are enrolled in an Indian tribe or eligible for enrollment.
Ms. Ellis-Nutton, this language, is this new language the federal to the federal language, and is that why we're adding it to this to Minnesota statute?
Madam Chair, this is, I would say, complementary language to make it clear that the Indian Child Welfare Act applies to all Indian children, and that the determination as to whether an Indian child is, in fact, an Indian child is a tribal determination.
So federal law has always been, but Minnesota law has just not been as crisp about.
There are many of us who would believe that Minnesota law has been crisp, so to speak. However, in the recent past, there have been legal arguments made in Minnesota and in other states that a child is not Indian enough, quote unquote, for application of the Indian Child Welfare Act. And while people have made those legal arguments, we believe that the Indian Child Welfare Act is very clear in terms of the recognition of the importance of Indian children to Indian tribes and the government responsibility from Congress to our sovereign tribal nations and the application of the Indian Child Welfare Act to these children.
Please proceed.
Section 14 of the bill deals with the Federal Timely and Safe Interstate Placement of Children Act and provides time frames for completing home studies as well as providing requirements regarding contact with children who are placed outside of Minnesota every 6 months, and it also provides provisions for acceptance and dissemination of incentive funds for any home studies completed within 30 days. I'm not sure that that's likely to occur, but if Minnesota does receive those incentive funds, they would go back to the agencies that earned them. Section 15 of the bill provides foster parents, pre-adoptive parents, and relative caregivers with the right versus the opportunity to be heard in any hearing involving the child. Under federal law, previously, those individuals were to be given an opportunity to be heard, but with the recent changes at the congressional level, they're to be given the right to be heard. Section 16 is also a federal requirement, and this is to ensure that in any permanency hearing, the court is to ensure that there's an age-appropriate consultation with the child so that the child has at least a voice in the proceedings about him or herself. Section 17 deals with clarifications to trial home visits. A couple of years ago, you passed a law that allowed for trial home visits in situations where children were returning home from foster care. At that time, the legislation did not count trial home visits towards the permanency time clocks. The federal regulations have changed on that issue, and we must count the time in trial home visit to the permanency time clock, but the law does provide that should the 12 months permanency hearing come up at a time that the child is in a trial home visit, that the court can continue that trial visit. Section 18 of the bill simply provides that the court-ordered out-of-home placement plan includes specific recruitment efforts about the child and the most recent health and education records available. Section 20 of the bill corresponds to the sections I mentioned earlier regarding the 14-year-olds who are wards of the state. And that is it, Chair members.
Madam Chair and members, I also would like to point out that the department has worked very closely with the tribes, and we have some tribal representatives who are here who wish to speak in support of this bill or respond to questions in case you have any questions for them.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the witness. You began your comments saying that there's been legal arguments made in Minnesota regarding definition of, did I hear it right, Indian child? I think you paraphrased how Indian is an Indian child. What do you mean by that?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Senator Limmer, and I, there's other people who can also respond to this question. There has been legal arguments made in court proceedings that a child has not had enough connection with an Indian family or an Indian tribe in order for the Indian Child Welfare Act to apply. However, the Indian Child Welfare Act very clearly states that it is applicable to all Indian children who are enrolled in Indian tribes or eligible for enrollment.
Madam Chair, is
Senator Lemmer.
If an Indian child is, let's say, half Indian and half Caucasian, what happens to an Indian child?
Sullivan Sutton.
Madam Chair, Senator, one thing I want to point out is the Indian Child Welfare Act only applies to child custody proceedings. It does not apply to family court situations. But if a child is part Indian, it is still a tribal determination as to whether that child is eligible for tribal enrollment. However, there are also placement preferences under the Indian Child Welfare Act that a child be placed with a relative, and there is not a preference as to whether it would be the Caucasian relative or the Indian relative.
And, Madam Chair, this kind of reminds me of former Chief Justice Blatz had a similar bill many years ago regarding placement of minority children. But in state law, and it was a very contentious issue in the legislature of whether or not to simply recognize the need for a parent, and the law kind of relaxed the requirement that a minority child had to be adopted into a minority family. And then you got into the percentages of if it was a half minority, half Caucasian, or two different types of minorities as the offspring of the child, where did that child go? And it got to the point where it was rather contentious because, at least at that time, if my memory serves me correctly, there may not have been enough families to adopt a child. And then when the child was adopted into a Caucasian home, when a request was made, the child was removed from the Caucasian home and moved to a minority home that had requested that child. And it put a lot of confusion to the part of the child. And at that time, Representative Blatz, who later became Chief Justice, had chief authored that bill. And I'm just wondering if there's any comparisons to this bill as to what Minnesota's former policy was in this type of area.
Senator Torres-Reid, you said you have some advocates or professionals who have been working on this bill with the department. Why don't we have them come to the
Madam
table?
Chair and members of the committee, the department is going to respond to your question, Senator Limmer. The good thing about having the history is that Ms. Sullivan was serving with the department at the time that happened, so she's fully aware of some of the efforts at the time Representative Ladd. So she would like to respond to your question, and then we have other people who could also respond.
Madam Chair, Senator, you are correct. There are history there. The distinction to be made here is that the federal law was changed, and it was very clear that you cannot make placement decisions based on race. So you cannot delay or deny placement based on race. The situation under the Indian Child Welfare Act is distinguished from that because it recognizes the political status of Indian children within tribes, so it's not a racial distinction.
Welcome, Judge, to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Andrew Small, Madam Chair. I'm just here to answer some questions. We had a large part in helping draft this bill, and if you would like any further clarification relative to this provision, I can provide that.
Okay. Any further questions to the witnesses? Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't understand this area of law well, but
I've got a letter here from someone named Lisa Morris. Is she here today?
Yep.
Okay, you guys are familiar with her.
Yes.
And her situation. She wanted her letter put into the record. I don't know if we have to do that, but she cites a section 1911 of the child custody of the Indian Child Welfare Law that says that the state court can basically, as I understand it, retain jurisdiction over the child, whether it's foster care, termination of parental rights. Whether the child is living on the reservation or not, as long as, basically it says that a parent can veto the transfer to tribal court. Is that still the law?
That's still the law. The parents of the child are the only named parties to the action that can register an objection and block a transfer to the tribal court. That's correct.
Okay. And this bill doesn't change that?
Not at all. No.
Okay. If you're familiar with what, how do you, you're familiar with her concern? Apparently there were some twin children that somebody she knew had been caring for 5 years, and then late at night they just came and were taken from the home and brought to a tribal court for jurisdiction. I don't know if I want to get into all the facts, but
Judge Small, can you identify yourself so that the members of the committee can know in what context, sort of some of your background?
Sure. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was a children's court judge in the tribal court, in the Prairie Island Tribal Court, for 10 years. I have worked in this area of the law since this law was passed by the federal government in 1978. I'm quite familiar with those people that would characterize themselves as opponents to this bill. And they're typically people that, non-Indian people, that wish to, out of goodwill, wish to adopt Indian children and find this law somewhat constraining because there are certain provisions that have to be undertaken in order to get through to that point of adoption in order to protect the child's relationship to his or her tribe. And Lisa Morris from Montana is one of the most vocal. She's a head of a small group, a Christian Alliance for Indian Child Welfare. It's a rather small group, but she's quite vocal, and she has strong opinions. But I have to tell you that in all due respect to her, that there's a modicum of exaggeration in what she relates.
Right. Well, as I understand, Madam Chair, her issue, if you do have children that have been living off the reservation for quite some time and maybe have no connection whatsoever to the tribe itself, the tribe still has the authority to say, you qualify, you're a member of the tribe, and we're taking jurisdiction, and basically pull them back to tribal court?
Well, we have to...
Judge?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Senator, we have to be a little bit careful about mixing up the steps under the Act, okay. But as Ms. Sullivan Sutton said, the first question is whether or not a child is a member of a tribe or eligible for membership in a tribe. And the federal law says, and the state law says in case law in the tribal state agreement, that is solely a tribal determination. So if a child ends up in state court, the law says that the tribe has exclusive jurisdiction if they're residing on the reservation or domiciled on the reservation, or if they're already a ward of the tribal court and they happen to be off the reservation when this occurred, then it's exclusive tribal jurisdiction. It's understood to be concurrent jurisdiction if a child is living off the reservation and the preferred jurisdiction under the Act is the Indian tribal court. Now, if you have a situation like you're suggesting and someone asks to transfer the matter to tribal court, you have the parental objection that can block that transfer. And the court can also look at something called good cause not to transfer the case to the tribal court. So in that sense, it's not an automatic, unless there's exclusive jurisdictions, it's not an automatic control of the case by the tribe. But that certainly the intent of the law is to try to have this taken care of by the people that know their own values and beliefs and traditions better than someone from the outside.
And this bill doesn't change that?
Absolutely not, no.
Okay. Well, wish I understood it better to ask the right questions. I just don't know what questions to ask.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, in that area, I've had the honor of working with Ms. Sullivan Sutton for a good many years, and the statutes have a tendency to change several times a year on the federal level, and it's hard to track that, and I appreciate the wisdom that she's brought to us. I think it would be very helpful in the future if you could bring copies of the statutes that mandate whatever function you're talking about so that this committee and its successors can pursue that.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we would be happy to do that. Thank you.
Senator Neville.
One other area I just want to get into a little bit more is, what are we changing about the 14-year-old's consent? Are we now saying that if you're 15 or 16, you still don't have the right to object?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton?
Madam Chair, Senator, no. Under current law, when a child is made a ward of the state, the agency has an obligation to look for a permanent family for a child. But there is a provision that allows the agency to ask a 14-year-old if they want to choose not to be adopted. Frankly, what that does is lets the system off the hook to ask a 14-year-old to waive the opportunity to have a family. And so what we're saying is, let's get rid of the waiver, or get rid of the affidavit, have the agency continue to efforts to try to work with the child about whether they want to be adopted and to find an adoptive family. What continues to exist, though, is that the child will continue all the way until they're 18 to have the right to consent to an adoption with a particular family, so you would never force a child into an adoption situation. But we continue to hear from adolescents all of the time that what they didn't get was a family. And so we believe that as a system, we have an obligation for kids under our care to do everything we can to find them a permanent family so that they have somewhere to go when they're 19 or 23 or 30. It doesn't always happen, but what we're finding more and more with specialized recruitment efforts and oftentimes having that child drive the whole recruitment process, we're being much more successful in finding teenagers adoptive families.
Very good. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 1221 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, the effort of this bill, is it in now we're recognizing a compact relationship with the federal government? Is that what this is doing?
Ms. Sullivan Sutton?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it is not. The relationship to the federal requirements that are mentioned are having to do with a bill that was passed by Congress this past fall that's called the Safe and Timely Interstate Placement Act. Now, it's related to an interstate compact, which defines the procedures, but it's not the same thing.
If there's no further discussion, is anybody in the audience who's here to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson renews her motion. Senate File 1221, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Dahl. Senator Dahl, Senate File 1525. Is this your first time in front of this committee,
this
Senator
Dahl?
This
is my first time, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Senator Dahl, whatever Senator Carlson or Senator Olson has told you, they're wrong.
It's worse. They got me scared. I'm sure. But unfortunately, I've got a pretty simple bill. It's an agency bill.
That's what they all say.
Well, I brought Mr. Keno here to be able to defend anything that comes up. So, members, Madam Chair, this Senate File 1525, it is an agency bill, and it's what it's basically doing is modifying the state pipeline safety code to comply with federal regulations. It's the one part of our state code that hasn't been upgraded yet. to meet with those federal standards. It's taking the daily maximum penalty for a violation from $10,000 to $100,000 and the maximum violation from $500,000 to $1 million. I don't believe there's any opposition in the industry at all for this, but I have Mr. Key, Charles Key now. He's the administrator for the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety with me to explain a little bit more and answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Key now.
Madam Chair, members, we have automatically adopted all the other federal codes as part of the Pipeline Safety Act, and this one has been lingering for some time, and what we're seeing is the need to change this in order to still maintain our federal grant, the maximum amount of federal funding that we can receive. Annually, we have an audit, and we get 50% of our grants from the federal Department of Transportation. And one of the questions on their audit is, are our standards comparable with the federal standards? And this is one area where it's not. So we need to fix this in order so that we don't lose any additional points and therefore federal funding to support our program. The as was mentioned, the federal government has changed their standards three times, and our office was created actually 20 years ago this year, and we haven't raised or changed that that penalty since then. So we think it's time to bring it in line with the federal penalty, and that's what we're proposing to do with this bill.
Mr. Keenow, the amounts are quite substantial. And those are federal amounts?
That's correct, Madam Chair. There were several major pipeline incidents in the last few years which resulted in Congress raising the penalty. You probably heard of Carlsbad and New Mexico, and also Bellingham, Washington, where several people were killed in those pipeline incidents. As a result of that, the standards were raised in the Federal Pipeline Safety Act in 2005.
Ms. Kinnell, would be inaccurate to then characterize this as basically a technical federal conformity bill?
Madam Chair, members, that's the way I would characterize it.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, who gets the money?
We want it.
I'm kind of curious.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, that goes into the pipeline safety account, and it helps to defray the operations of our office.
Say no more. Okay.
Darn.
Okay.
Move the bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1525 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. Is that agreeable, members? Senator Neville, is that agreeable? Senator Limmer is not here. I would ask him, being the lead on the committee. Senator Ortman, is that agreeable?
Aye.
All right. On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Okay. Motion passes. There you go. Go
Thank
tell
you.
Senator
Thank you.
Paulson.
All right.
And
it's not at all what they said it was going to be like.
Thank you, Mr. Keenow.
Don't worry.
Yeah. Run quick.
She's here. I have a little amendment to your bill. He was on Almanac last night.
Senator Higgins, I thought you had a meeting to go.
It got canceled. It was with the chair of the House committee that matches up with our division, and they're a tad busy right now. So.
Oh, just a teeny tiny bit. All right. Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
How's that for timing?
Yeah, she just walked in right as...
We missed her on the chart.
Senate File 310, poor Senator Berglund has been on the agenda, off the agenda, on the agenda for a long time. We're glad you're able to accommodate us.
Right. Unfortunately, however, the physicians I've worked with on this bill are not able to be here today to testify. But I do. We did have a hearing on this bill in the Health and Family, Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee. And because this bill deals with commitment, then this is a second referral. The bill itself deals with chemical dependency. And today, in fact, for the last 10 years, we've had in statute laws that say that if you are addicted to drugs, can be, and you are pregnant, you can be committed. And the threat of commitment in many cases has gotten women into treatment so that they could have a safe and normal delivery and normal child. We have not had in our statutes, however, the same ability for women that are addicted to alcohol. And I have in the packets for you a picture of the brain of 2 6-week-old newborns. The brain on the right is a normal developing brain of a 6-week-old child. The brain on the left is a brain of a child that has fetal alcohol syndrome due to chemical abuse during the mother's pregnancy. Children with fetal alcohol syndrome are very expensive for us to take care of in our society. But that's not the main reason that I'm here with the bill. The main reason I'm here with the bill is because these children live very frustrating lives. They are very oftentimes, it's very difficult for them to hold down a job. Sometimes it's very difficult for them to do activities that you normally would have to do to live independently. And yet, in many cases, they're not considered a person with mental retardation, so they're not able to get services that otherwise would be available to a person that might be suffering from mental retardation in order to be able to have the assistance to live an independent life. The bill that is here before you is a bill that, after 10 years of experience with threat of commitment for women who have substance abuse other than alcohol, what we've learned is that it is not a deterrent for women seeking prenatal care. We have learned that in many cases, women with the threat of commitment do seek chemical dependency treatment. So this bill would add alcohol to the commitment statutes in these cases. And I believe that alcohol still is the most abused drug. I believe if we can pass this bill, we will help women to be able to get into treatment because of the threat of commitment otherwise that would be over their head.
Members, in your packet, you are all looking at me a little bit puzzled, and I want to let you know that you have a copy of Senator Betzel's Senate File 322, the first engrossment, as well as Senator Berglund's Senate File 310. And the reason for that is because, and it sounds familiar to you, because we've had testimony on alcohol and its impact on the children who are born to women who consume alcohol when they're pregnant. And that was, we took very good testimony, Senator Berglund, and when we had Senator Betzel's bill before us. And I just, I wanted to have a chance to discuss your bill in the context of what we've done with Senator Betzel's bill. Senator Betzel, is your bill on general orders? Or
Madam Chair, and maybe I should raise this question. My bill went from this committee to the Finance Committee just to see if there was any fiscal impact. There was none. And it's still stuck in the Finance Committee. Now, my bill has been moving over in the other body, so, you know, so the thing is alive. And I'm just wondering whether it might make sense if Senator Burke, if we can go through and explain what my bill did, because it does line up quite nicely with what Senator Berglund's bill does, and if she would not object to it, if we can explain it to her, if we could amend this bill onto hers, and if my bill moves, you know, maybe we can also amend hers onto mine, and whichever one winds up getting to where it gets, we can get them both enacted. Senator Berglund, I had a bill, Senate File 322, which also deals with the civil commitment statute, but it deals with the side of, and the doctors that we brought in here testified that there are some instances where the chemical dependency is habitual, but it's not quite excessive enough to meet the standards of civil commitment. And whereas your bill does, where the woman is both habitually and excessively using alcohol or abusing alcohol, obviously there is a problem with the fetal alcohol syndrome. But in those situations where they're using it a lot, but not quite enough to meet the threshold of civil commitment, the bill that I had would have allowed what's called early intervention, so that the physician, and the physician said, you know, we would rarely use this, but, you know, when we're down to nothing else, you know, sometimes we got to get their attention, and this would at least allow us to get them into a very short-term program. Again, if it's not habitual and excessive, but they are abusing alcohol, my bill would address that situation, whereas your bill deals with they are using it habitually and excessively. So there's two sides of this, but they both kind of work together.
Sure.
And if you know, do you have a copy of it, sir?
I don't.
Let me get.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify a point, and maybe Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius could help me out with this, because I remember the doctor who was here earlier talking about the word excessive and saying really medically and scientifically there any use of alcohol during a pregnancy would be considered excessive from her standpoint, because there was a possibility that any amount of alcohol, provided it happened at the right time in a pregnancy, could cause damage. And so my concern with that bill was just that from a legal standpoint, is excessive defined somewhere for – I see Ms. Pontius is shaking her head. No. And I just wonder if we're just opening a real can of worms in terms of how is this – do we need to define this term more clearly for the court so that we give some direction so there isn't going to be a lot of medical – testimony or the doctors are not going to have enough guidance to know when they can implement this and when they can't?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this is an area of the law that I've practiced in for about 27 years. It's never really been defined, but frankly, there, when you're dealing with chemical dependency commitments, there's not a lot of close calls. I mean, there's people that clearly abuse, you know, them, and it's not just habitual and excessive use. It's at least a commitment, but it's got to cause you to a danger to yourself or others. It has to be you're unable to provide some of your basic needs. There has to be a lot of things in there, but it isn't. One of the things I had some concern about is that. Although I recognize that even a little alcohol during pregnancy can cause a problem, I don't know that we could be able to pass a law that says that any pregnant woman who is using alcohol is subject to civil commitment, because I don't think that would ever pass around here. So I think it's got to be, you know, looking at more specific cases here. So,
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, to me that's exactly what we are doing, though. Because it doesn't say habitual and excessive. It says habitual or excessive. And the testimony that even one drink could be considered excessive and a potential threat to the child. I mean, as an adult, when you're using alcohol, I think the fact that you have to show you're in a commitment that you're a threat to yourself or someone else means something. But when we're talking about this in the sense of with an unborn child, I guess I'm just wondering if there's going to be, if we should define that in any way more clearly.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
And Senator Olson. Again, current law, if you look on page, Senator Berglund's bill, if you look on page 1, line 10, the standard is habitual and excessive. Now, those terms are not defined in statute. But and this is a bit of a different, because on page 2, line 2, the standard would be habitual or excessive. But they are not defined. I don't know that there's an easy way. It's one of those things when the judge says, okay, it looks quite habitual. You know, if you're drinking every day, that's habitual. And if you're drinking a lot, but if you're only drinking, you know, binge drinking once in a while, every couple of months, it may be excessive, but it's not habitual. So that's why the two terms, habitual annex, have been put together. This could wind up being, you know, habitual or excessive. You could be habitual, having, you know, one drink every day. It's not excessive. Or you could binge drink, you know, every couple of months. That's excessive. It may not be habitual, though. So but it is different. But during pregnancy, the consequences, of course, you know, are quite severe to the fetus, even if they're not severe to the mother's health.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I don't pretend that this legislation is going to cure every situation where a woman might consume alcohol and it might have a negative effect on a fetus. But there are a lot of cases where it's pretty clear that that's what's going to happen. And it's those cases that we think maybe this law could help. Madam Chair, I also just have a question for Senator Betzel. I'm just trying to find where in your law you're amending the definition of chemically dependent person for the purposes of the commitment law.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, when I was contacted actually 2 or 3 years ago by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, we had a bill last session, and this is really an iteration of that. When I was first getting working on it, my concern was, again, they initially wanted just to simply lower the standard to make it easier to commit a woman who was drinking during pregnancy. And I had a concern. I said, that kind of thing probably is not going to pass, because then you're talking about every woman in the state who might be drinking during pregnancy and might cause fetal alcohol syndrome. But I had some concerns about that. However, there is a provision in the commitment statute, 253B, that talks about early intervention. That section was written, and I carried the legislation on that, mainly for mentally ill people, because as a mentally ill person is sliding down and not taking medications and so forth, some of those individuals you can kind of intercept on the way down before they hit rock bottom, get them bumped back on the track, but you only need a short period of time to do that. That type of a description normally doesn't fit for early intervention for chemical dependency people. There aren't chemical dependency people who are kind of going down the slippery slope and heading towards rock bottom because they're drinking more today than they did yesterday. But I did think that at least the use of a short-term treatment for a small group of women, you know, who are drinking but not so excessively or habitually to cause themselves to be committed, but are clearly causing some problems with their drinking, I thought that might qualify for a type of early intervention. But early intervention only gives you a maximum of 21 days of treatment. So it's a different part of the commitment statute that I looked at to amend it. It still falls under the commitment statute, but it's the early intervention part.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, the idea here would be to combine these two?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, if you are interested, I think
that
those
would
two
be
work
fine.
Together. So,
yeah, that would be fine.
So Senator Betzel moves that.
The contents of Senate File 322, I believe as amended,
First
engrossment be amended onto Senate File 310.
Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I'll move bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 310, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to
the floor.
To the Senate floor. Any further discussions?
Yes.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund or Senator Betzel, do we have any idea whether any women have ever, in fact, been committed for drug use under the current law?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, yes, there have been, and there have been many more who have gone into treatment because of threat of commitment. And in fact, we've had some of those women in front of my division this year talking to us about how they were able to change their lives and talking to us about that, you know, if they hadn't been under threat of commitment, they probably wouldn't have gone into treatment. So,
Senator
Neville,
is there some way that we can get some numbers or statistics on how often this has been used?
Well, I imagine the court must have them. I don't. The
court would have them?
And
I don't know if they have it.
Would it be human services
or computerized fashion? But
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, there is a provision in law, and Senator Berglund may have been the author of it, on the cocaine babies. There's a provision to all civil commitment for women who are abusing cocaine, and that's already been on the books for a number of years now. Those cases rarely come up, but they do. And I don't recall. I mean, Hennepin County, frankly, you know, probably has more civil commitment cases than anybody else in the state. I don't remember very many cases that I've seen coming up dealing with the pregnant women, but it does happen. And you know, Senator Berglund obviously has more information on it, but obviously even the current laws haven't quite gotten to where we need to, as you had the testimony from my witnesses, and as she's had to.
Well,
that was an
initiative.
You
know,
Senator Neville.
Part of the reason I ask is that when you add marijuana and alcohol, chances are you're going to quite substantially increase the numbers that will be subject to mandatory reporting and at least investigation. How can there not be a fiscal note when we add alcohol and marijuana? Because every doctor, every school teacher, you know, basically anybody who has knowledge has a mandatory duty now to report to the sheriff or the social service agency, and then they have a duty to investigate. Don't you think that by adding alcohol that there's got to be a fiscal note?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, it might have some fiscal impact at the county level, but it will far be offset by the reduced fiscal impact they have of taking care of these fetal alcohol children.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
That assumes
we don't usually look for fiscal impact for the counties in the Finance Committee.
Okay. Well, that assumes that that there won't be a commitment and that people will change. If there's a commitment, then there's a state cost. And it also assumes that the state would have an expense because women wouldn't have an abortion if they were forced into a commitment proceeding or the threat thereof.
Madam Chair and Senator.
Senator Berglund.
They would be committed to a treatment program.
Right.
And
would that,
you know,
not be paid for by state funds?
It would depend on what their financial situation is.
Right. Senator Betzel, why did your bill not trigger a fiscal note?
Well, Madam Chair, I sent it to the Finance Committee, and in fact, I can go grab the fiscal note on it right now. There was no fiscal impact. The Judiciary Budget Division reviewed my bill. There was no fiscal impact, and mine actually had a lower standard because you didn't have to prove habitual or excessive use. You know, do it with, at least with Senator Berglund, that's a bit of a higher standard that you have to prove one or the other. Mine did not require either. And there was no fiscal impact to it. So, I mean, that's the way it came back. So I sent it to the Finance Committee just because I thought there could be, and there turned out there was none.
Senator Neville.
Senator Betzel, did you have a local government fiscal note or just a state one?
Madam Chair, can you hold on for a minute? I can. My office is just right next door. I'll go get it. It's what Senate file was it? 322.
Here with that. Any other questions for Senator Berglund?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Wasn't this Governor Arnie Carlson's wife's initiative a few years back, and that she was promoting that? I would say that the Department of Health one of those agencies would have some data on that, because it seemed to me that they were somewhat successful in identifying folks that had that problem.
Madam Chair, I also just can speak to the second part of Senator Neville's concern here. There is no evidence that the commitment law for women who are abusing drugs has increased the abortion rate. And today, with methamphetamine, there are actually some women who end up under threat of commitment because they're abusing multiple things and because methamphetamine is involved in one of the things that they're abusing, then they are able to get them into commitment, even though they may be more concerned about the alcohol than they are about the methamphetamine. There's been no evidence that it has had that impact, and there is no evidence that it has had the impact of women avoiding seeking prenatal care.
Okay.
Senator Betzel is going to go make copies of his fiscal note for us to look at.
Actually, Madam Chair, I don't object to moving it to the floor. Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Let's move it.
Did you have a
question, Senator Allison? Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to address Senator Neville's concerns because in the district where I live, this is an enormous cost for our education system, our law enforcement system, our social service system, dealing with the results of fetal alcohol syndrome in particular is a really expensive lifelong proposition. So the little bit of money that might be attached to this, if we were really to look at all those factors, I'm sure would be far outweighed by the savings.
I think I concur.
Okay. Have we moved the bill yet?
You've moved it at least twice, Senator Higgins.
I'm really on the ball today, aren't I?
But what I you just want to get to your bill.
That's true. Yeah. And then I'm thinking beyond that a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I'm supposed to be in transportation right now. I think that's why Senators Limmer and Ortman have left.
Well, let's get cooking.
Okay. Well, you know, we'll let Senator Betzel bring the fiscal note back so we can have it as part of the record on the bill, and then we'll move it. Because now this fiscal note is going to be attached to your bill, Senator Berglund.
Well, great.
It's a preliminary one, but it shows no cost.
And we've moved the bill at least three times while you were gone, Senator Betzel. So, Senate File 310, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor, as moved by Senator Higgins.
Over and over again.
Over and over again. Anybody in the audience here to testify on for or against Senate File 310? See none. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Senator Berglund has had good luck in this committee, hasn't she?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund spent many years on this committee because she had so many bills coming before this committee. And then we wound up having the health committee and this committee meeting at the same time, and so she had to rotate off of it. So.
Thank you. Senator Higgins, Senate File 443.
Chair, this is a bill that would regulate scrap metal dealers in an attempt to cut off the cash dealings for people who are stealing scrap metal at record-breaking levels. This changed quite a bit in the last committee, and it is now requiring that scrap metal dealers be part of the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. And for those of you who've been around the crime prevention issues longer than I have, you may know this as the network that runs Amber Alerts. But you may not know that there are 8,000 businesses in the state who are also connected to this network, as well as every law enforcement agency in the state. It is right now a faxed system of alerts that go out to businesses, and in 15 or 20 days it'll become a web-based system. It's very easy to go online and sign up as a scrap metal dealer, give the information that's required, and then sign up for whatever kind of alerts you think are appropriate for your business. There are, at this point, 14 scrap metal dealers who are signed up for this alert, and they've had some success in
In one case in St. Paul, the police department issued an alert about a burglary business from which $700,000 worth of manufacturing equipment was stolen. The equipment was really unique, and the police investigator speculated that the thief wouldn't be able to find a market for it, and so might choose to try to melt it down for about $20,000 worth of scrap value. So he put out an alert to the scrap metal dealers on the MCAN, and one of the dealers actually called to report that he had already melted it down, but he knew who he had bought it from, and the suspect was later arrested. In Oakdale, the police alerted scrap metal dealers about $4,000 worth of aluminum bleachers that somebody had dismantled and stolen from a high school and park. Within 2 days, a Twin Cities scrap metal dealer who was on the system called to report that three guys had been in to sell the bleachers. So I had originally tried, the proposal was to have scrap metal dealers be part of the automated pawn system, and that caused everybody and his uncle a whole bunch of heartburn. A very nice person at the BCA told me about this program. I didn't know about it before. And in the Business and Jobs and Industry Committee, it was very well received that the scrap metal folks would become part of this system. We also require in this bill that the scrap metal dealers must collect quite a bit of information about its customers. And then we keep existing language about they don't have to keep records from, you know, the merchants and manufacturers and wholesale dealers, kind of their big basic business partners. We require that all payment is by check. The thing that I heard from local governments all over the state, police departments said that this is 100% meth related, and it is so easy for somebody to go steal something and go to the guys who hand out in cash. We put total prohibition of payment by cash for everything except like the pop cans that the Boy Scouts bring in, that kind of thing. There are criminal penalties in here. If you look at the memo that Mr. Backus prepared and Ms. Pawnee has prepared, there are judiciary issues. One of them would be the data practices information, and then the two criminal prohibitions. And I don't know where to start telling you about those because that's not something I know a whole lot about. Although I do know that the data practices language that is in here is, I believe, the same as the pawn broker's piece of the statute.
Senator Higgins, one of the issues that that popped into my head as I was looking at this is that with respect to the information that's collected, where is it deposited?
Madam Chair, the dealer has to keep it for 3 years, it says in here, and they must make it available to law enforcement if law enforcement has a need for it.
So, Senator Higgins, it doesn't get wired to a central depository?
Pardon me?
It doesn't get wired to a central depository?
That was what I had originally done. That is no longer what the bill does.
And the when the dealers sign up, then they are at the receiving end of the alert that's coming to them. So they don't send any information about their client base to law enforcement, but actually they receive alerts from law enforcement about products that might or might not show up on the market.
That's true. And then they are also required, if they have suspicious items coming into their shop, they are to notify the police, who will then put the alert out going the other direction.
And I see in here that it says that the scrap metal dealer may not disclose personal information concerning a customer without consent unless the disclosure is made in response to a request from law enforcement agency.
So if law enforcement is looking for somebody or looking for a particular piece of information, law enforcement basically has free access to the information that's the files information that the dealer has, his or her file?
Madam Chair, that's the way I understand it, and I think that's exactly the way it works now.
Mm.
That the scrap metal dealers have always had a kind of an open-door policy for the police to come in, walk around the yards, see what is there, and you know, when they are trying to find who may have sold a product, you know, that information is, you know, and it may be a piece of paper stuck on a spindle at this point. But they have been pretty open to that, is my understanding.
And Senator Higgins, is there any protection built in for the individuals from law enforcement who goes on kind of fishing expeditions?
Say more about that, Madam Chair.
Well, what I'm concerned about is, you know, the potential harassment aspect of it. If law enforcement goes out and, you know, if the scrap metal dealer doesn't have a trigger for why they will open up their records to law enforcement. And I mean, I can't think about the specific situation right now, but I'm concerned about law enforcement and, you know, going out and it isn't even just a fishing expedition of the records of the clients, but I'm concerned about the scrap metal dealers themselves being the subject of kind of, you know, harassing contact by law enforcement if there's a suspicion or non-suspicion. I mean, for any reason, law enforcement could keep going back to scrap metal dealers saying, open up your files, open up your files. If we don't build in some kind of trigger for them to have to say, you know, some kind of standards that we have reasonable suspicion that you might have materials or, I mean, I just, I'm a little bit concerned about how open this is, how open-ended it is, both to the access of the information, but to the access, you know, of the scrap metal dealers. Maybe other committee members don't have that issue, and certainly don't. Well, Senator Olson.
I guess I always have that concern when it comes to just there has to be some type of probable cause to trigger a search, I think. I don't know how it passes constitutional muster if you don't have some kind of a probable cause trigger. I had one other concern, Senator Higgins. I'm looking at on the second page from lines 2.17 down to 2.23, the information that the scrap metal dealer is supposed to get and maintain includes the person's driver's license number, their full name, photograph, birth date, and signature. Now, that's just, to me, everything someone would need to steal someone's identity. And so I would want to know that there was some restriction on how they have to maintain that information safely, that it isn't just in a computer file that could be very easily broken into. And I mean, when we have credit cards and they don't even contain all of that information, when we require stores and other places to get rid of this information so that it can't be easily accessed and stolen by identity thieves. So if they're going to get everything that someone would need to be able to steal someone's identity, I think we have to have a safeguard in place to make sure that that information is not easily accessible to someone else who could use it.
Madam Chair, maybe Ms. Pontius can find an appropriate place to put in some protection language that would take care of that. I know that on the top of page 3, we talk about the scrap metal dealer who may not disclose the personal information without consent, you know, and then it defines personal information and talks about the data collected by the law enforcement agency is private, and on about the customers and public about the property.
and I believe we need that distinction.
Sure.
Maybe if Ms. Pontius or Mr. Backus, whoever's working on this bill, can work on it. Madam Chair, it occurs to me, and now that I've said Mr. Backus's name, he prepared the A9 amendment for me. I think it's technical in nature, but we can have it handed out at some point. Madam Chair and members, the first line of the amendment deletes a definition that I don't think we any longer have in the bill. And then Mr. Backus nicely got rid of a few therewiths and thereofs and suches. And I highly approve. So, Madam Chair, there are no questions on the A9 item. Move the A9 amendment, please.
Senator Higgins moves the A9 amendment. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussions? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, on page 3.27. What we're doing in subdivision 5 is creating a new crime for anybody who doesn't comply with this section. But then in subdivision 4, we're saying that they have to actively participate in the network and they must implement an aggressive management practice. And I wonder if that's sufficient definition. I'm not sure what active participation or aggressive management means. And if you don't do that, apparently you're guilty of a gross misdemeanor. Can you tell us what you intend to be active participation?
Yes, I can.
Madam Chair, Senator
Neville, I mean by this language that the flow of information needs to go both ways. As I said, when the information, when a suspicious transaction or a suspicious customer comes to the door, that they need to get the information to the police. It also means that when they sign up for the email or fax alerts, they can't sign up some computer that's in the basement that they turn on every couple of weeks. Have to be actively participating. It has to be, a form of information, a data collection that they get, that they work with basically daily to get the information.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I'm not that familiar with the Crime Alert Network. Is that computer or fax or either?
It can be either. They get to choose when they sign up which they would like to do.
Okay. And is there something in that, is that by law, that if you sign up for it, you have therefore a duty to reply back if you have knowledge that you possess stolen property?
I have the books that come with it, and I have to admit I don't know, but this was part of the in my moving away from the pawn system, but I guess I just believe so strongly that the information has to go both ways, and without looking through this, I can't tell you whether it would be in here that, information must go both ways. I know that is the way that it works.
Well, I would assume that in order to make this a crime, what we have to do is say you have to actually enroll in the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. You must at all times make sure you're receiving. And then if you have knowledge that you've got something that was sent to you, you have a duty to report it. Now, I don't know if that's already incorporated into the sign-up of this network, isn't it? Because otherwise, you're going to have people who are going to say, I got the fax machine or I got the computer. I'm getting it. I told my employees if something comes across that they should report it. And they'll say, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hard to prosecute a crime without being able to prove actual knowledge if you don't create the duty.
Yeah.
Possibly you can help with in subdivision 4 on page 3 that says that more explicitly.
Well, Well, that's the first part. But then, the second part, trying to figure if we're going to, should we be criminalizing whether they implement an aggressive management policy?
Madam Chair, I don't think that passes constitutional muster in terms of defining what constitutes a crime. I mean, you can't have a definition of something that's a crime that's somehow subjective, because it'll just it won't be upheld. So I think the intent is a good one, but I think that the language would have to be much more tightly drawn to put people on notice of what a crime would be under this.
Well, Senator Olson, Senator Neville, I mean, whether you put in comfort language about aggressive management or not, you create the obligation once they sign up for the program. So my sense is that you can eliminate that sentence, and it builds in sort of an implied, I mean, we don't care how they manage their business.
Well, yes, we do, Madam Chair. Very much we do. I mean, if they just sign up for the computer thing and then they don't make any efforts to stop, their employees from, just saying, oh, sure, yeah, I'll take all your stuff. No, we do care how they manage there. I mean, maybe the criminal penalty part, maybe that shouldn't be in the criminal penalty part. Maybe it should be a section all its own. That's up to you guys. But
Senator Higgins,
we do
what
care
I,
how they manage their building.
What I was going to finish saying is that from a criminal penalty perspective, we can't criminalize people's style of management and how they manage their staff. And so what you care about is the result, that they're responsive to the policy that you want to put in place. How they respond to it, whether they respond aggressively to it. I mean, we just care that the result shows that they're meeting the policy that you want them to meet.
Okay,
we can't dictate to them you do aggressively or passively or lackadaisically. That's when I say we don't care. I mean, from a criminal penalty perspective, we could almost eliminate that sentence, but we should make sure to build in that there should be, some kind of a result, which is that, they're signing up $50 to participate. When they get the alert, they have to check. I mean, they have to check their inventory, or they have to, shoot back some kind of response to say, we got the alert. We don't have the information. I mean, if you create some kind of a connection to close the loop, I think that's how you can hold them accountable, because if Mr. Scrap Metal Dealer sends you back a little email saying, or fax back saying, we checked our inventory and it's, we don't have anything that looks like this, but you come in to do kind of a spot check and you find that it's there, that's how you hold them accountable.
Madam Chair, would we fix this problem if we took subdivision 4 on page 3 and made it a new section? Because the criminal penalty says talks about complying with this section or buys and receives scrap metal that the dealer knowingly or should reasonably know is something they shouldn't take. Would that fix the problem?
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I don't think it does. We probably should massage this a little bit, because should it be a gross misdemeanor if you pay cash for something that's legit? That's not as serious, it seems to me, as buying stuff that you just received one of those alerts from and you know that it's stolen and you take it anyway. Qualitatively, they're different. Maybe one should be a misdemeanor, maybe one should be a gross, or maybe one should be subject to a civil penalty instead of a crime. So I'm not sure that just pulling subdivision 4 out.
Mr. Backus, can you share with us what your thought was?
Madam Chair and members, it went to Senator Higgins' comment, not Senator Neville's, but
on page 3, line 34, before section, if you inserted subdivisions, I guess would be just to make it a little faster, subdivisions 1 to 3 and 6, 6 and 7 of the section. I mean, that would clearly then not penalize the violation of subdivision 4.
But subdivision 4, Madam Chair, clearly ought to be deleted. That when you're looking at the starts right out, the metal dealer must register and pay an annual fee of $50. And I don't see how you could mandate for some private organization to do that. And the whole the aggressive management practices certainly wouldn't hold water, and the establishing a training program wouldn't either. So I think that pretty well eliminates the whole character. And I would move that we strike subdivision 4 on page 3.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
We can't do that.
That's how
we get everybody to participate in this system. And the system will not work without requiring that they are part of the system. If you only have a dozen scrap metal dealers and you've got 120 of them in the state, we're not going to get anywhere, and the houses in my district are still going to keep exploding, and the telephone companies are going to keep losing all of their wire, and the electric, the Parsons Electric people will still have spindles of $30,000 worth of copper being stolen from their workplaces. We've got to have a way that we can require them to be part of this. And
Senator,
I believe the Scrap Metal Dealers Association does not disagree with that.
Madam Chair.
We've got to have them be part of this, and we've got to have them have training for their employees. So I highly disagree with that amendment that Senator Foley is trying to amend. We just can't do it. That guts the whole bill, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
In response to that, I agree with what you're saying, but the direction you're going here isn't the way to do that. I think that what you have to do is establish some kind of a licensure practice that deals with people that handle that, and conditions of that licensure that continue to hold that would be that if they complied with the training program and reported it to the police and so forth. That I can see, but absent some way of forcing that, you're not going to do that.
If we put it in the law, we force them to do it.
Senator Higgins, under current law, when people registered with the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, do they pay a $50 fee?
Madam Chair, right now the businesses pay a $12 fee, and Superintendent O'Malley and Ms. Rasmussen, who runs the network, said that there would be increased cost for adding them on, and so the $50 fee would pay for that increase. So,
Madam Chair,
that's how we got to that number. Yes, everybody does pay to be on the network.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
Senator Higgins, do pawn shop operators, are they required right now to be a part of this? I mean, do we have a comparable criminal law that would require someone in private business to register for something like this, maybe with pawn shop dealers or anything like that?
Mary, most come on over. They are not required to be on this network. There are a lot of pawn shops who are on this network. This is Mary Peterson, who runs the automated pawn system. She works for the city of Minneapolis, and some of the municipalities require that they all on it.
Are you speaking about the Crime Alert Network?
No, talk about the APS.
Oh,
Ms. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Restate your name and your position for the record.
Mary Peterson, City of Minneapolis.
Is it Peterson?
Yes, Pederson. Minneapolis Police Department Automated Pawn System is my job assignment. Were you referring to pawn shops being a part of the Crime Alert Network?
Madam Chair,
what I was asking was whether we have any kind of a requirement with a criminal penalty attached to it that they have to be part of that, of this, that they have to pay a registration fee and that they have to be a part of it.
No, they don't participate in the Crime Alert Network.
But Ms. Pedersen, they do subscribe to and they do pay to the automated.
To the automated pawn system, yes.
They pay a lot of money.
They don't pay
part of the automated pawn system.
No, they are regulated by their local county or city ordinance. And the transaction fee is charged by the county or the city law enforcement agency that regulates them and licenses them. So that's how it occurs.
But for the most part, Madam Chair, the local units of government who regulate them tend to be in the metro area and the St. Cloud, Duluth, and many of the yards are somewhere. Wouldn't be regulated.
Senator Higgins, I know you're frustrated. But I think that what this committee wants to do is to help you put together a bill. And you're a member of this committee, you know that everyone is thoughtful. And what we want to be able to do is put together something that is pretty solid when you do take it out of here so that it's not vulnerable to specific types of challenges. And if we are going to send something out of this committee, we ought to try to make it our best effort. So have a little bit of patience with us, okay? Senator Foley, will you withdraw your motion until we have a further discussion?
I do think, though, Your Honor, that Madam Chair, sorry about this.
My honor is good, too, Senator Foley. Senator Higgins, Senator Foley has withdrawn his motion to delete subdivision 4.
But can we talk to the City of Minneapolis and say, what does your ordinance say and how does this function?
Sure. Copy of the ordinance if you want to make a copy. It's a lengthy ordinance, and all of the 180 agencies that, the 74 agencies that, or 42 agencies of 80 stores. So there's 42 different counties and cities that have these ordinances, and there's 80 stores right now contributing data. And pretty much all of their ordinances look surprisingly the same. They have all the same model language. And it's, I don't have a copy of it here. I thought I did. I have a copy of the state statute.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, can you get a copy of the ordinance and use that as a vehicle to provide enforcement?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, that's where we started this bill.
We started
this bill requiring that people be connected into the automated pawn system.
Wow.
And that wasn't going to ever get out of Senator Metzen's committee. And so we have come to this.
Senator Higgins, I like the direction that you've gone. I think that the idea of being on the alert system is a good one. I think that to have the scrap metal dealers subscribe to this system and they be alerted by it is a good one. I would like to, but I think that it is also important to have them on the record saying that they've seen the alert. I think that's the accountability piece that you're looking for in terms of feedback, that they have seen the alert, not just, the facts came through, we don't know if we've seen it. I mean, I think that that's the accountability piece of it. So subdivision 4, I think we might need to rewrite that or redo something with that. And then if you want to build in there some kind of training and education for the scrap metal dealers and their employees, you could require an annual in-service for updates of, statutes or ordinances with respect to what it is that they're doing. I'm just suggesting this, and see if the BCA or whoever is running the Minnesota Crime Alert Network is willing to put that on, I think, again, that's a piece of, you know, that you can build into it, because I think most professions have continuing education classes, regulatory update opportunities, and you might want to, you know, consider that. So for that piece of it, without explicitly saying we want you to have good management skills or we want you to actively participate, I mean, I think you build into the membership, you know, specific criteria to so that you can just have something to hold them accountable to what you want them to do. Senator Higgins?
A couple of things. That would cost way more than $50 a person if we're going to have the BCA set this up. There are 8,000 companies that are now getting this information. I don't know how we tell the BCA to say treat these guys differently than everybody else in this system. And I lost the other point. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, going back to Subdivision 4, can we... The second sentence says must. The third sentence says should. Can we take those two sentences, put them in a separate subdivision, and make them both shoulds? Would that help a little? I picked this information right off of the Institute for Scrap Metal, whatever they are's, website.
Madam Chair.
That's their suggestion. You know, institute aggressive management practices. Develop a training program. So not like they haven't heard it before. Possibly they should be in the should category rather than the
must. Senator Higgins, I understand what you're trying to do here, but if – and it's up to you. I mean, this is your bill. But if what I heard you say is that there's a desire on your part, and as a member of this committee, I would like to see that too, to make sure that the scrap metal dealers and their employees, you know, have these educational opportunities, then we ought to treat them like a profession, like any other professions that come through here, where we do have that requirement. The BCA, whoever puts the educational courses together, do not necessarily have to run them for free. Most, you know, individuals who do this pay a nominal fee to take their classes in order to fulfill the requirement. So I'm not trying to sabotage the bill. I just want, I think Ms. Pedersen is nodding, and I just want to give you some ideas. At the end of the day, they're probably all angry with me because I'm expecting them to do more. But I think if we're going to do something with a little bit more teeth, then we should. You know, think about how to do sequence that so that we can have them do it in the way that is similar to what other professions do.
Madam Chair, the BCA would not be running these courses that they would be taking. I assume that their trade organization, they would be getting those. So it would not be from the BCA. I mean, BCA has no knowledge of how to run a scrap yard.
Sure. And I think that, you know... they may already currently have workshops, I mean, annual meetings, whatever will fit in. I think that's something to think about. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, to get at, I think what you, to get away from the subjectivity of these kinds of standards, but to keep some teeth in what you want to do. And I think, you know, if you did what you wanted to do, what you're going to lose is something that has any teeth in it. So I was thinking about this, and I was just wondering, what about if you said something very specific, like at least once within every 24-hour period, a scrap metal dealer must download from the system this information, and for purposes of the section that has to do with enforcing when they buy stolen property, will be presumed to have received the information, you know, any information that's come through within 24 hours or something like that, so that you put a burden on them and a penalty and a reason why they'd want to check this, because otherwise, you see where I'm going with this, Senator Neville? I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the language would be, but you basically make it a presumption in law that they're going to have seen this information so that they're going to have to be a part of this to want to... They're going to want to cooperate, because otherwise there'll be a penalty if they don't.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, those are all really good ideas. I think the, if I remember correctly from what they told us when they were demonstrating the program, if the emails either aren't opened or the fax machine is not working and does not receive, they get that information back, and they do log right after they send it out. Within like a minute, a log comes back up of everybody who's received it, and you know. And so I do know that they track that information carefully. But I kind of like the idea of they must, you know. Well, in the email system, that would work. You know, you must check your email for alerts from MCAN once every 24 hours. I don't know how you'd say that if they signed up for the fax alerts, but maybe we can figure something out there.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, maybe that they must review one way or the other, but we put some kind of very specific parameters around this, and then you get away from the problems of being unconstitutionally vague in terms of a violation. And then you can also put the presumption in terms of the stolen property tied into that in something that's reasonable, so that they have so that they can't use this excuse that they didn't know property was stolen.
That is an issue. You're right.
Okay.
And Senator Higgins, I think that in the data section, there's a. I know that you said that the area where we talk about the collection of data, you borrow the language from the automated pond system, but I think there's a little bit of confusion here in terms of law enforcement. How does the information, when it gets, how does it go from investigative data becomes, how does it go from confidential data to investigative data? And Ms. Pontius, I was asking her about this because I'm a little bit confused too. Can you help illuminate for us this language from line 3.8 to 3.12? Or am I just confused?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, my only question was, under the law enforcement data statute, if it's investigative data, it's confidential. And I thought perhaps maybe some clarifying language would need to be included here, because I assume in some of these cases they are going to look at this data and they're going to start a criminal investigation. And you want to just make it clear that in those cases then the law enforcement data statute would apply, so it would be confidential and not private. And it may just be a question of including a cross-reference here. I know you indicated this language came from the pawnbroker statute. I'm not familiar with that one. It may be a problem in current law there as well.
Ms. Pontius, is from 13.8 to subdivision 27, I believe. It's not like it's I knew that.
So we'll have Ms. Pontius make a note of that.
Okay.
So that we can, you know, as we're dealing with that, she'll do the cross-reference to make it clear. Are you okay with that?
Sure, whatever we need to fix that, yeah. So that it's clear what is private, what's not private.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
I don't want to delay this, but what you're looking at in section or subdivision 4 is a scrap metal dealer registering with the annual fee and so forth. Can't we just start out with something that says that every scrap metal dealer must report the purchase of and follow whatever the materials that we previously cited, and so that there'd be some course of action that's mandated that will resolve notifying the police or the nearest police agency a way to enforce that.
We could, Senator Foley, and I think that's a good suggestion for Senator Higgins to think about. Senator Higgins, this is what I'm thinking.
As well.
This is what I'm thinking, is that I think it's good to get input from the members, and I will commit to you that we will bring this bill back.
Okay.
But I think that if it is as important to you as I see that it is, I think that you would want our help to make this good, a good bill. And so what I would like to do is to take questions, testimonies, get members' input, and have any of you who have a particular section that you have some concerns about, perhaps you should work with Senator Higgins on that particular section. I know a couple of areas that I want to work directly with Senator Higgins on and see if we can put an amendment together that will put this bill in the shape that will have it be workable, because we would hate to send a product out of here that may have some holes in it that would be vulnerable to challenges.
Chair, I really want it to be workable too.
Yes.
It's a huge problem. It's been called an epidemic. Scrap metal theft, and we just have to do
everything that we can
to get it stopped. So if people have they would like to talk to me about with this, I'd be pleased to work with you.
Will I
be working with Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius on an amendment?
I believe it will be Mr. Backus.
Okay.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins.
I'm sorry. Both of them.
Okie doke.
Okay. I was just going to, do these dealers have to be licensed? Or can anybody go into the scrap metal business?
Are they licensed?
Ms. Patterson.
It depends on where they are, whether or not they have an ordinance regulating them.
So the state doesn't, but some local governments might.
Right. Yes. Right.
Okay,
many do.
I was trying to think of a way that we could maybe condition their license on signing up with this Crime Victims Network.
Say it again.
I was trying to think of a way we could create a hook to have a consequence that isn't a gross misdemeanor. I mean, my thought is, I've been just trying to study this, is that subdivisions 1, 2, and 3 should be misdemeanors. And then subdivision 5, subdivision 4, we should just say you have to sign up.
Have to do it.
And there's a presumption that whatever comes out on the network, there's a presumption you got it. And then subdivision 5 is really the guts of it, which is, if a dealer actually buys something that he knows or should have known was stolen, then it's a gross misdemeanor. And we're going to presume that he got the stuff, so the burden would be on him to prove that he didn't. I don't know if that would work or not, but that was kind of going along Senator Olson's line.
Chair, Senator Neville, do you want to set a threshold on value?
Well, Madam Chair, we already have a theft threshold.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I guess
receiving stolen property. So, if it's over $1,000, it's going to be a felony. If it's under that, it's going to be a gross, I guess.
For the person who stole it.
Actually, this your subdivision 5 doesn't really define a value. It defines it by the kind of property that's stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So they would also have the option of getting charged under the stolen property if they knew it was stolen. Do you think that the normal receiving stolen property would be good enough, or do we need to specifically itemize these kinds of metallic products?
Senator Higgins, I think that the Senator Neville is raising some good points that I have written on my paper here, too, that I think where there are already laws in existence, that we can cross-reference that will make it consistent, like current, threshold levels for the theft or current law about receiving stolen, products, that why don't we try to cross-reference those bodies of law so that you don't have to recreate, you know, other laws to govern this. And as much as possible, let's look at cross-referencing for consistency.
Chair and Senator Neville, I think I know why railroad, telephone, gas, and all of those things are specifically spelled out in Subdivision 5 and because of the safety issue, the public safety, you know, if you stealing gas lines, you know, buildings go boom. Interestingly, I think it was in Italy, the whole train system in the country shut down because some fool had stolen the transformers for the train system.
That didn't meet a high dollar amount.
And it wasn't very much, yeah, that's right.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, another thought that's occurring to me as we're talking about this is if you really, really want to get to the scrap metal dealers, you could consider some kind of a provision about civil liability that would say something along the lines that if they haven't complied with the provisions in this section, that they would be liable to the owner for the value of any, you know, stolen property recovered there, and maybe even for any damages associated with the theft. I mean, that'll really give them an incentive to be complying with the statute probably more than almost anything else you could do. I mean, that would be pretty onerous. That would be a pretty heavy burden. But
Senator Olson and Senator Higgins, my sense is that there are two types of people we want to address in this bill. There are the business people who are the scrap metal dealers, and then there are the people who steal the metals and try to pass them off or sell them to the scrap metal dealers. I'm not quite at the point where I want to write off the scrap metal dealers themselves as the bad guys. I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt that these are hardworking men and women operating a business where they're trying to get by like the rest of us. And I think what we would like to do is, in how we craft this, though, to give them an opportunity to be the good people that we know them to be, to work in partnership with law enforcement to address the issue of stolen scrap metal. I think that's a good premise to go on, so that we should think about that. Because at the end of the day, these are, you know, maybe there are some bad eggs in the basket. But these are still business people trying to make a living, doing their business, and we want to help them so that they can do what they need to do, which they think is a good business for them, or they wouldn't be doing. So we want to help them, but the way we want to help them is to give them the tools to be working in partnership with us and with law enforcement to regulate the way they do their business so that it doesn't taint how they do their business. And I think that's important to think about. Then the other group of people then are the individuals, not the ones who are legitimately selling scrap metals, but the bad apples who are stealing them and trying to make money off of them. And of that second group of people, I think we can do the cross-references to the stolen items. If we need to add something that's specific that's not covered in the stolen item and the theft statutes, you know, we could look at how we address that. But I think as we move forward, it's important to kind of separate that so that if we're going to regulate, then we regulate them as two separate groups of people, and we don't end up confusing, you know, who the owners of the business are and who the actual sellers of the scrap metals are. Is that agreeable?
To the best that we can do that, Madam Chair, that would be a good thing. Mm-hmm.
I know where you want to go with. I know where you
I'm
want to go.
I'm trying not Senator, to go there, Madam Chair.
I know where you want to go, Senator Higgins. But I think that it's. I know where you want to go. I know where you want to go. But I think.
It's a real problem, Madam Chair.
Yes, I know it is.
I've heard from all over the state about this problem, and there are scrap metal dealers all over the state, and some of them are the mom and pops, and you know they are. Just, you know, maybe they're the business that they inherited from their dad. Then we have some fairly sophisticated organizations that, and many of them are implementing these same sorts of policies and procedures so that they don't receive stolen materials as the best that they can do. Then there's everybody in the middle.
And there's a lot of, if you talk to the police, and you should talk to the police in St. Paul, there's a lot of wink and nods. There's a lot of turning the blind eye. And there's just a lot of things where they just don't know. So it's been, difficult for everybody to get their hands around. And I truly, even though I'm cranky about this, I truly appreciate everybody's help on this. I do want to put something together that will work.
Yes, and we want to work with you.
And so at this point, can we just lay it
aside
for
another
day?
And we'll bring
day?
It back.
And
we'll bring it back.
Yep. Mr. Backus works really well at trying to figure out what I'm trying to say. And so.
And members, I strongly encourage you to give your good constructive feedback to Senator Higgins so that we can have clearly it's an issue, and we want to be responsive and want to be helpful to Senator Higgins. So please give her your feedback. You can provide that to Senator Higgins and or to Ms. Pondius and Mr. Backus. The bill has been laid over, and that's it for our agenda today. So we are adjourned.